This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Three great stories about how the ocean is changing this hour. In just a bit, you'll hear from a researcher studying how our fate and the fate of salt marshes are intertwined. And a woman who went to the Great Pacific Garbage Patch tells us what she found in the stomachs of fish who live there. First, the South Asian monsoon provides the drinking water for 1.5 billion people each year. It brings more than two-thirds of India's rainfall and accounts for more than half of the water that Indian farmers use to grow crops. It's so important that it's been called the real finance minister of India. That was a quote from the actual finance minister of India a few years ago. That means a lot of people want to know how much rain the monsoon will bring. Just a 10% increase causes major floods, while a 10% decrease causes drought. Meteorologists try to predict when the monsoon will arrive and how much rain it will bring from year to year. But what about zooming out a bit more? Can we see trends going back 100 years? And what might happen in the future? My guest today has been using corals to try to get at some of those questions. Conrad Huyen is a senior scientist in marine chemistry and geochemistry at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Conrad, welcome to Living Lab.
Hi, Heather. Thanks. It's great to be here.
Okay, corals are animals that live in the ocean. How long do they actually live? I mean, we tend to think of them as being these big rocky structures. How long do the animal parts actually live?
So the corals that we work with are the massive kinds, the boulders. Some corals look like branching plants and some look like great big rocks. And they're actually colonies. The animals themselves are tiny. And the rock that you see is the living part is just the surface skin of individual polyps covering what looks like a big rock. And that rock is actually the skeleton that these small polyps produce as they grow.
So how long can, to make a boulder like that, how long does that take?
These large boulder corals can live for hundreds of years. The polyps, these tiny animals, can be only a millimeter tall. But they produce a skeleton beneath them. And as they grow, they leave that skeleton behind. And they grow at different rates through the year. And as a result, they end up having differences in density that produce these bands in their skeleton.
I mean, as you're saying that, I'm thinking this sounds like tree rings.
Absolutely. That's a perfect analogy. They leave bands in their skeleton that can be counted back through time just like tree rings so that we can identify layers that grew several hundred years ago with great precision.
So essentially, is it the same animal that was alive hundreds of years ago? Or because they're colonial, I mean, I guess that's that question of, you know, if you keep a car and drive it for 250,000 miles, but you've replaced every part, is it the same car? Is it still the same animal hundreds of years later?
That's a great question. These are colonies, so it's more a question of are these the same animals? And genetically, the answer is yes, but their offspring, the individual, does not live all that long, but they will get replaced by other small polyps, and the overall colony, the big boulder that we see, stays in one place and continues to grow and is alive through what can be many hundreds of years.
How would you use this animal or its skeleton to understand what's going on in terms of weather nearby?
When corals build their skeletons, they have to use the chemistry of the water around them to literally put together a calcium carbonate skeleton. As corals build their skeleton, they have to take components from the seawater around them. And of course, the calcium carbonate comes from the seawater, but there are other elements as well. So the other elements, the contaminants in the seawater, also get incorporated into the coral skeleton. In some cases, the amount of a given element that gets put into the skeleton can change as a function of temperature. In other cases, the chemistry of the water can change, and that will be incorporated into the skeleton as the coral grows. So the coral skeleton chemistry is a recorder of the environment at the time that the coral was growing.
All right, that makes sense, that the coral's growing in the water. It's reflecting the water in its skeleton. But then how is what's in the water related to something like the Indian monsoon?
This work started quite a while ago in the Red Sea. We started drilling for coral cores along the Saudi Arabian coast to try and reconstruct climate conditions in the Red Sea over the past several centuries. A couple of the sites that we took cores from happened to be located in an area where winds coming off of the African continent or blow dust into the Red Sea. This happens every year. The winds that are coming into the Red Sea, blowing from Africa through mountain gaps, bringing dust with them, are very strongly associated with the winds of the summer monsoon, the Indian monsoon.
I mean, this is quite a chain for someone who's a marine biologist and studies corals. You're connecting winds in Africa to winds and rain in India and the dust that they're carrying. How do you start to even put that together to figure out what you should be looking for in the corals?
That's a fantastic question. Maybe I should back up a bit. As a paleoclimatologist, our job is to try and reconstruct past climate changes. And corals are, as I've mentioned, very amazing archives when it comes to being able to reconstruct past climate because of their annual banding that gives us good dating. And because they live for many centuries, they're like meteorological stations in the ocean recording climate continuously. And all of those records are out there just waiting to be read. So when we try and reconstruct climate from a given area, we know that the coral skeletons have recorded many different processes. They record temperature, they record salinity, they record, for example, things like river runoff. And this is all due to the different kinds of chemistry in their skeletons. And we can look at different aspects to reconstruct different climate parameters.
And so then when you look at these corals in the Red Sea, you're seeing some chemical reflection of how much dust. Is more dust a reflection of stronger winds? And then what does that mean in terms of how much rain actually falls in India? How do you connect those dots?
To put together a story of how corals in the Red Sea could be reflecting the strength of winds in the Indian monsoon, there are a number of pieces that do get put together like in a chain. We know that the winds that blow across the southern Red Sea are associated with the larger scale pattern of winds that are the summer Asian monsoon. So if we can reconstruct the strength of the winds blowing over the Red Sea, then we can use that as a proxy to say this also must be reflecting what was happening with the larger scale monsoon circulation. The trick then would be how can we reconstruct winds over the Red Sea using corals? And it turns out that one of the many chemical indicators that we can use in corals is the element barium. Barium is fairly concentrated in soils and sediments on land and river runoff entering the ocean. And the ocean is relatively empty of barium. So when river runoff or dust from land enters the ocean, it brings with it a very large, relatively large barium signal that then enters the ocean and is a local barium spike. The corals that are growing in an area where the dust is entering the Red Sea are recording the barium in that dust in their skeletons as they grow. So as we go back through time and look at the levels of barium in the coral, that tells us about the amount of dust that entered the ocean and how strong the winds were.
So what has happened? What is the story that you're getting out of these Red Sea corals? Have monsoons been getting stronger? Have they been getting weaker? Or is there kind of no change that we're seeing over the past few hundred years?
Well, the corals that we got go back about 250 years. And there are two corals that we used to try and replicate the dust signature to make sure that we were getting something that actually represented the water. And what those corals show us is that over the past 250 years, the monsoon winds have been increasing in strength, but they've actually been decreasing in their variability. So it looks like the monsoon winds have been getting stronger, but also more stable, again, over the course of the past 250 years.
Is that something that would be consistent with our understanding of climate change, or does that seem like just a natural process that's been happening?
It's a combination of both. When we go back in time as much as 250 years, then we're dealing with a combination of things that are causing climate to change. We know that over the past 100 years, the global temperature has been increasing. Anthropogenic climate change is increasing global temperatures on land and in the ocean. And we expect that to have an impact on climate systems, certainly in the recent past and as we move into the future. If we go farther back in time, though, we're not dealing with human-induced changes, and we're starting to look at the natural pattern of background variability. And this is one of the things that paleoclimate studies are so valuable for, because paleoclimate studies allow us to investigate what the natural patterns of climate change are, and then we can look at how those may be changing in the presence of human forcing, which is critical for trying to be able to predict what may happen in the future.
And so do you think, based on what you've seen so far, that this trend will continue, that we're likely to see stronger but more predictable monsoons in India going forward?
We would predict, based on global temperatures increasing, that the monsoon should be getting stronger. But when we look at instrumental records of monsoon rainfall averaged all over India, we actually see that over the past 50 years or so, the rainfall has been decreasing. And this has been confusing because, again, computer models and just physics suggest that the monsoon circulation should be increasing as temperatures increase. Our coral records show that the monsoon wind strength has been increasing over the past 250 years, and this is consistent with what we would expect based on the physics. So the question becomes, why has monsoon rainfall been decreasing when it's predicted to increase?
And when it seems like you've actually got data from the corals showing that it has in the past, at least in the more distant past, and in the longer term, been increasing.
That's right. Our corals show us that the monsoon winds have been increasing over the past 250 years. And so the question then becomes, why has that increase slowed or stopped in the most recent past? And one of the reasons may be other changes to the climate system besides temperature. One of the things, of course, is that we're increasing the amount of pollutants, things like soot or sulfate aerosols in the air, especially over India.
I mean, here in the U.S., we've actually, for the past few decades, been decreasing those, right? So that's another one of those. It's kind of regional. In India, air pollution is still increasing, presumably enough to affect their weather systems.
That's right. The amount of aerosols and soot pollution in the air can have a number of different impacts on climate. It shades the surface and will cool the surface, and this will counteract some of the warming that we would expect to be making the monsoon stronger. In addition, sulfate aerosols can actually change the circulation itself, not just through warming of the surface, but through vertical interactions with the air masses. And so the presence of pollution in the air can serve to decrease the strength of the monsoon, even as the overall temperature on a larger scale would be trying to make the monsoon increase.
When we hear about corals and climate change, for the most part, it's not what you're talking about here, using corals to understand climate change, but instead it's hearing about the impacts of climate change on corals. Most recently, over the past couple of months, been hearing the results of surveys on the Great Barrier Reef showing that as much as 2/3 of the coral has died in the past couple of years as a result of a bleaching event. How dire is the outlook for corals globally?
The outlook for corals globally is clearly not a good one. With increases in temperature, coral bleaching is occurring more rapidly, more frequently than it has in the past. And as we saw this last year, some of these bleaching events can be very widespread and much more severe than they've been in the past. So coral bleaching events appear to be increasing in both intensity and frequency, and this does not bode well for the survival of coral reefs as we know them.
Does that have an impact on your research? I mean, if corals are suffering, you're losing your record, right?
When corals die, the living tissue, which is that thin layer over the top of the large boulder, ceases to grow. But the skeleton beneath will remain intact for many years. Eventually, other organisms, bioeroders, will invade the skeleton and will start to erode it, and eventually the skeleton will disappear. But in the meantime, it's still possible to take coral cores and to recover the actual record that still is contained within the skeleton.
There's another threat also facing corals in addition to the kind of the heat and the bleaching that produces, and that's actually changes in ocean chemistry, the acidification of the ocean. Is that expected to get bad enough that it could actually start eating away at the coral skeletons?
Yes, ocean acidification is a second global scale threat to coral reef survival. As ocean acidification continues and the pH in the ocean changes, it becomes harder and harder for corals to produce a calcium carbonate skeleton. The rate of ocean acidification does not appear to be as grave a threat to coral survival as temperature. But in the long term, if the oceans become acidic enough, then corals would no longer be able to produce skeletons. And although some corals appear to be able to survive in a different form, clearly the survival of coral reefs as the integrated ecosystems that we know would no longer be possible.
The case has been made that we should value corals, of course, because they're beautiful. People love to enjoy them, essentially as wonders of the world. Do you think that perhaps the fact that corals are another way that we can understand our climate, they're a resource, a scientific resource as well, is that another case that could be made for trying to save corals?
Clearly, the value of corals as recorders of past climate change is high, and corals should be preserved as much as possible for this reason as well as many others. Corals are beautiful and provide an economic resource for tourism. It's also extremely important that we try and preserve the biodiversity that is found on coral reefs. The organisms living there and the diversity of organisms possess a large amount of chemistry. There are natural products contained in the organisms living on coral reefs that are still not entirely cataloged, and there's a good chance that there may be bioactive compounds contained in coral organisms.
I mean, there's been a sunscreen developed from corals, right? And looking at medicines, I mean, that's what you mean by a bioactive compound, that we could actually find medicines in corals?
Exactly. It's because of the fact that corals, and in many parts of the natural kingdom, there are organisms that use their chemistry to fight back against predation, to prevent themselves from being eaten. So in the coral reefs, there are many different organisms that produce a large number of compounds that could be turned into medicines. And the prospecting of these resources is ongoing, but is by no means complete. So we would want to preserve coral reefs as long as possible to continue to be able to access the potential medicines that they may possess. And in addition, coral reefs have value in their physical existence for protecting shorelines. Coral reefs have been shown to protect villages from tsunamis or hurricanes. And in the case of the Indonesian earthquake 10 years ago, there were locations where the tsunami traveled inland many kilometers, wiping out villages in areas where the coral reefs had been destroyed through dynamite fishing. Whereas in nearby villages where the coral reefs were intact, the waves did not penetrate inland nearly as far, and villages did not suffer nearly as much.
When you're out in a place like the Red Sea, scuba diving to get coral skeleton samples for your research, do you ever get a chance to just stop and look around you and enjoy the beauty of where you are and what you're doing?
There's no question that working in coral reefs is a joy. Certainly when we start working at a given site, we're scouting around, looking for large corals that we can drill, basically doing reconnaissance. And you have no choice but to look around and to enjoy the beauty of the location. But it is funny, sometimes when we're actually working and we're drilling a core, sitting on top of a massive coral that can be 20 feet tall, the largest ones that we've ever seen can be up to 30, 40 feet tall, individual colony, hundreds of years old. And when we're drilling, when we're actually taking a coral core and focusing intently on the work in front of us, it's like roughnecking with large equipment, moving it around, using wrenches. We have no idea what's going on around us. And sometimes after taking a core, I've had students come up and say, "Did you see the manta ray that was hovering right behind you?" And the answer, of course, is no, I did not see the manta ray that was hovering right behind my head while I was drilling.
Oh, that's too bad. Conrad Hewen is a senior scientist in marine chemistry and geochemistry at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. His lab has just finished an analysis of corals from the Mediterranean Sea that date back to 1760. And the corals there show that the South Asian monsoon has been getting stronger and less variable over the last 250 years. Conrad, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Heather. It's great to be here.
I'm Heather Goldstone. Up next, an expedition to the Central Pacific to study plastic pollution. Living Lab continues after a short break.